Welcome to yet another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. Let's go ahead and open to 1 Kings chapter 1 and begin at verse 49 with the story that we closed up with last session. And that is the attempt by Adonijah to declare himself the new king of United Israel, even though his father David is still alive. And we know that quite a few key persons in David's kingdom are going along with Adonijah's coronation, which is taking place in the Kidron Valley off to the south of the city of Jerusalem at En-Rogel. Adonijah is somewhere in his 30s. This is about the 37th year of King David's reign. David's about 67. He's got health issues, and at this particular time, he seems to be bedridden. And so Adonijah decides now's the time for him to take over the kingdom. Everybody was kind of expecting he would be the next king anyway, since he's the oldest surviving son of David. But he is not God's choice, nor David's choice. That would be Solomon, who at this time is traditionally about 15 years of age, and that seems to match our chronology pretty well. So David, when he is told about this coronation, immediately turns around and has an emergency coronation done for Solomon. And he has Solomon taken to the pool, the spring that feeds Jerusalem itself, the Gihon spring. He's taken there on David's mule, and all of the personnel in David's kingdom that are loyal to David, they're at this coronation, and all the people of the city are immediately informed that this is what's going on and that Solomon is the new king. And as soon as the celebratory noises of Solomon's coronation reach the ears of those at Adonijah's coronation, less than a mile away, they all begin to panic, because they are now participants in an illegal ceremony. They are all potentially guilty of being involved in a coup. And that is a death penalty offense. And that is why we read in 1 Kings 1:49, "Then all the guests of Adonijah trembled and rose, and each went his own way." So they scatter. And Adonijah feared Shlomo, Solomon, and so he arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. So Adonijah sees the reality that Solomon is now the king. Yes, David is still alive, but Solomon is the one who is going to be exercising authority. And as such, Adonijah could be brought up on charges and executed by his much younger brother. So he runs away past Jerusalem, just a couple of miles up to the northwest, to the tabernacle, to the site of corporate worship. And he runs into the court of Israel and grabs hold of one of the horns of the sacrificial bronze altar that's out in front of the tabernacle shrine tent. Now, why does he do this? Well, these horns, which are made of bronze and probably do look like animal horns, oxen horns, these are the places where the priests will smear the blood of sacrifices offered for sin. So by reaching up and grab a hold of one of these altar horns, Adonijah is symbolically saying, I am pleading for forgiveness from God himself. And it's a symbolic way of asking for forgiveness from a human person as well. You're throwing yourself on the mercy of God, therefore throwing yourself on the mercy of the human ruler. You're asking for sanctuary and amnesty. Verse 51. Then it was told Solomon, remember, he's only about 15. Behold, Adonijah fears King Solomon, for behold, he has laid hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me first that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. So he is making an official petition that he will not be executed as a traitor to the new king, as a usurper to the throne, because that's a death penalty. And so Solomon said, if, notice the conditionality here, if he will show himself a worthy man, that is a trustworthy man, not one of his hairs shall fall to the earth, but if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So Solomon offers forgiveness for this traitorous episode, provided Adonijah doesn't try anything like it ever again. That's going to be important. So King Solomon sent, and they brought him down from the altar. That is, Adonijah is brought back to Jerusalem from the tabernacle at Gibeon. It's only a couple of miles. And he came and paid homage to King Solomon, which means he bowed down on the ground in front of King Solomon to show that he accepts him as the king of United Israel. It's kind of a strange thing for the cultures of this time period in this part of the world, because Adonijah is at least probably 20 years older than Solomon. But he is accepting his much younger brother as God's king. And so Solomon said to him, go to your house. And so that is the end of the problem for the moment. Then David is going to start working with Solomon about the establishment of Solomon's kingdom, including the building of the temple and the reorganization of the entire kingdom. For this, I think if you go to 1 Chronicles 23, that's going to be kind of a target area that I'm going to recommend to you. At the same time, though, I would say that I've taken a lot of the lists full of names here and reduced them to chart form that we Westerners kind of like, and it's in my Chronological Companion to the Bible. And you can find that on my program websites, intotheword2020.com and also intotheword.net. Just look for PDF resources and look for the Chronological Companion to the Bible. All it is a very detailed outline of the chronological history of Scripture, and there's tons and tons of notes in it. And so I'm looking at chart number 11, which I've labeled David's Organization of the Kingdom. And it represents everything in 1 Chronicles 23 through 27. So 1 Chronicles 23:1 says, when David was old and full of years. Now he will die right around his 70th year of life. And right now he's at least 67, so his upper 60s is what we're talking about here, the final 3 years of his life. He has declared publicly that Solomon is the next king, and now he wants to organize for young Solomon, who is still a teenager, how the kingdom should be run. And not just simply how should it be run in legal areas and in military areas, but how should the religious things happen as well. Now, the first thing I go over in the chart is right here in chapter 23 of 1 Chronicles, and it's also chapter 24 and 25, and that is the organization of the priestly divisions. So David comes up with this idea, probably at the prompting of the Holy Spirit, it would seem, that there are going to be 24 divisions of priests and 24 divisions of Levites. And these guys are going to be working starting in their 20s and in their 30s, and they will keep working right up into their 50s. And these divisions will spread the work out throughout the year. The way that it would work is that each division is going to serve 1 week at a time, twice every year. That's the 24 divided into a Jewish year of either 52 weeks or sometimes in a leap year, that is a year that's got an extra month added into it, is going to be about 56 weeks long. So by that standard, each one of these divisions of priests and Levites, and the Levites that are mentioned in these lists, by the way, tend to be musical Levites that are highlighted. So these guys are going to come to Jerusalem, to the temple once it's built, spend a week, and then they'll go back to their homes, scattered all over the nation of Israel, and they will serve God in whatever capacity they do at that site for about 23 weeks, and then they'll come back for their next weekly service, and then go away for 23 weeks, and they'll just keep doing that. And over the years of their service, they will serve pretty much all through the year, because there's going to be a rotational shift because of the way that the Jewish calendar works. Now, the Jehoiarib priestly division will be the first one. And then it's got the whole list of all the different names of these divisions. One that should be of particular interest to us is number 8 on the list, which is the Abiya division. And the reason that's important to us is that is Zechariah's division. So that in the book of Luke, his division was spending their weekly service at the temple when Zechariah's name was selected and he went in and offered the sacrifices. Now, the prophets, the musicians, the Levites that serve, they've got names here as well that are listed, and those names are divided up between different families, like the Asaph family and the Jeduthun family, and the Heman family. All right, so that's, you can find all of that in chapters 23 through 25. Now, the next thing that is, I think, of interest here is that there's temple security. Once the temple is built, there's going to be thousands, tens of thousands, and eventually hundreds of thousands of Israelis visiting the temple building throughout the year, and particularly during the three mandatory festivals: Passover in the early spring, Pentecost in the later spring, and Tabernacles at the break between summer and fall. So you have to have security. Sometimes people won't behave themselves, so you need security for that. But also, you just need to have crowd control. Make sure everybody's playing fair, following the directions to get in and out, because they're going to have to rotate in and out of the worship area in order to get everybody in there in a timely fashion. Plus, you've just also got to be able to help people that get lost and people that need assistance of some sort. And so in chapter 23, but also in chapter 26, you have the four gates of approach to the eventual temple that David has security details for. The east gate has got six gate guards per shift. Now that's the most in this list on duty at a time. And I find it interesting, apparently David was anticipating that a lot of the pilgrims would approach the temple site from the eastern side. That'd be from the Mount of Olives site. Now, the north gate would have four gate guards on duty at a time. The south gate, which is the gate that you would approach the Temple Mount from when you're coming from Jerusalem, it has four gate guards on duty each shift. And then it had an additional two gate guards taking care of the storehouses, which presumably were built between the city of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. And what was in those storehouses? A variety of things, mostly the things that would be needed in the service of the temple or items that had been dedicated to God's temple. And then that leaves us our west gate, and that would have two gate guards each shift, but also an additional four guards that are on the road that's coming from that direction. And again, we don't know why there would be four road guards. It could be that since that's the direction you would approach from the sea, that maybe a lot of supplies would be coming up from that direction. And so it needed some people helping in all of that traffic. Now, David also names the head of security for each of these gate guards. And the south gate, we would recognize the name of the man in charge. His name is Obed-Edom. He's the one that's been taking care of the Ark of the Covenant that is currently being housed under a tent in David's palace in Jerusalem City. But once the temple is built, first Obed-Edom, then his sons, and then the descendants after them, they're going to shift their attention to the Temple Mount itself. And they will be helping people coming from the south gate to the temple where the Ark of the Covenant would eventually be located. All right, so the next thing that I want to talk about that comes up in this large section in 1 Chronicles is other Levitical assignments. And this is in chapter 23, but it's also in chapter 27. So you need general temple storage. And so David names some people that are in charge of that. So this would be the supplies needed for all the things that are going to be going on at the temple. Then you have to have the storage of dedicated battle gifts. You remember that every time David goes out and fights and wins, he gives a lot of the booty, a lot of the spoils of war to God's service. It's stored up to be used in the building of the temple and then eventually in the maintenance of the temple. So you got to have somebody that's keep track of all of that, accounting of that, and security of it. So those two areas are possibly those storage areas that needed the two guards per shift just south of the temple. Then David names some people to be in charge of the judges and officers that are scattered throughout all of Israel. Because you have to have a court system, you have to have a security system for every citizen, for all the different communities that are out there. And somebody needs to be in control of all that and make sure that there's not any gaps in coverage. So David names some people to take care of that. Then he also names for Solomon those Levitical leaders that are west of the Jordan and the Levitical leaders that are east of the Jordan and how they're going to be taking care of their business. Now, what's the business of the Levites? The business of the Levites is to provide spiritual leadership, answers to questions about the law of Moses and the application of the law of Moses, and to also instruct people. And so these Levites, they will be on service at Jerusalem twice a year for a week. Remember that? But the rest of the time, they're going to be living in all the communities throughout Israel. And somebody needs to coordinate all of those efforts. And so David is doing his best to make sure that all of Israel is being taken well care of, and that Solomon doesn't have to worry about this stuff as a teenager, as he is first getting started as king, because David's taking care of that. David is going to effectively give Solomon a turnkey operation. And these things appear to be inspired instructions from the Holy Spirit. All right, chapter 27 of 1 Chronicles also talks about these reserve military units that are going to be on duty in Jerusalem each month. So it's not the same soldiers providing a military presence at the capital city every single month. There's going to be 24,000 soldiers on duty at Jerusalem each month, but they're going to rotate out each month for 12 months of the year. And they give here in chapter 27 the names of the commanders of each of these reserve units that are rotating out. And the names of the commanders come from the names of the 30. And you remember that the 30 were the sub-commanders of the United Israeli Army. And so you'll see their names there. Then we also in chapter 27 of 1 Chronicles see the names of all the tribal leaders at the time that David is preparing to transition everything over to his son, Solomon. And doesn't hurt us. Let's just go through the list of those. And this starts in chapter 27, verse 16. Eleazar is in charge of the Reuben tribe. Shephatiah, the Simeon tribe. Hashabiah is over Levi. Zadok is the Aaronic leader. So he's the priest. Elihu, which would be one of David's brothers, is the Judah tribe leader. Omri is the Issachar leader. Ishmaiah is the Naphtali leader. Jeremot is the Zebulun leader. Hoshea is the Ephraim leader. And then the half-tribe of Manasseh that is on the west side of the Jordan is Joel, while the Manasseh leader on the Gilead side, the eastern side of the Jordan, is Edo. And then Dan is Azarel. He's the leader of the tribe of Dan. So these leaders will then shift over time. They will find their own replacements, or their tribal units will find their own replacements. But this is the starting leadership that will be assisting Solomon as he comes to the throne. And then that pretty much leaves only the overseers of the king's property, which is 1 Chronicles 27, starting at verse 25. And it's intriguing, some of the things that are listed here. You've got a guy that's in charge of all the storehouses of the king that are in the city of Jerusalem. And then David has another guy that's in charge of all of the royal storehouses everywhere else, scattered around the tribal areas of Israel. Then there's a guy that's in charge of all of David's and soon to be Solomon's agricultural workers. And then there's a guy that's in charge of all the vineyards that belong to the royal family. And then there's a guy that's in charge of all the wine storage the vintage collected from all of those vineyards. Then another guy is in charge of the olive and fig trees of the royal family that are down in the Shephelah foothills. And then there's a guy that's in charge of all the olive oil that's harvested from those places. And maybe he's also in charge of all the storage of the figs. But he's in charge of just keeping track of everything that's harvested. Then there's a guy that's in charge of all of the royal cattle that's being grazed down on the Mediterranean plain, down on the Sharon plain. And then there's another guy entirely that's in charge of the royal cattle that are being grazed in the valleys all around Jerusalem. Then there's a guy that's in charge of all the camels. I find that interesting because this guy is named Obil, and he's an Ishmaelite. And so this is a guy that is now giving his loyalty to David, but the Ishmaelites were known to keep camels. And so he's taking care of the royal family's camels. Then a guy that's in charge of all the royal family donkeys, and then another guy that's in charge of all the flocks, the sheep and the goats that belong to the royal family. And all of that logistics finishes up by the time we get to 1 Chronicles chapter 27. When we come back tomorrow, we will see the official coronation of Solomon as the king of United Israel that starts in 1 Chronicles 28.